So Dr. Dixon, you started turning your research into children's books when you were doing research in Fiji a few years ago. So I'm wondering, you know, what were you doing in Fiji and how did you even get the idea to turn it into children's books?
I was in Fiji doing my postdoc at Georgia Institute of Technology, and we were living actually in the village with the villagers, and I found that the more you engage with them on what you're doing and why it's important for them and how it can help them, the more helpful they are and the more sort of engaged they are with you and just talking. And they live there, so they have a lot of information that we can gain as researchers as well. And when I would talk to the adults, I found other ways to communicate with them, but the kids kind of were left out, and the kids are obviously really important for future generations. So I started making the children's books to help the kids understand what I was doing and why I thought it was important.
Great. And how did they respond to the books?
They love them. So I would make a book and have it printed out and give it to them, and they would always read it right away. And one of the books I had noticed while I was walking on the beach, there was quite a bit of garbage on the shoreline, and I saw one of the kids eating something and just throw the wrapper in the ocean. And so I made a book about trash in the ocean and, you know, the shark eats the can because it looks shiny like a fish and things like that. And the next day the kids were out there and they screamed to me from at my house that they were picking up all the trash on the beach. And they were like, look, we're helping. I was like, oh, good. So, I mean, they worked really well to the extent that the day after they read a book about how garbage can hurt animals, they started to pick up the garbage. So,
yeah, well, knowledge is power.
Yeah, definitely.
Right. And tell me about one of your books in progress, Once Upon a Reef, How the Tiny Gobies Saved Their Home. Tell me about what that was trying to portray in terms of your research and what the process was like in turning a paper full of, you know, jargony, esoteric terms into a story that could be understood by children.
So I think that story is actually one of my favorite stories. It was the first paper that I published in the journal Science, which as a scientist is a really big deal to get published in science in general. The paper is just it's a cool story about how different animals can communicate with each other through chemistry. So certain algae are toxic to coral, and they release these toxic chemicals that can kill the coral. And we see these algae on the reef, but they're not always killing the corals that they're next to. And I was trying to figure out what in the coral could potentially help save it from the algae. And one of the ideas I had was some of the animals that actually live in the coral. And there's these tiny coral gobies that live their entire lives in the coral. So they lay their eggs next to the coral, and then when they come back to the reef after developing in the open ocean, they come back to a coral, and they pretty much just live there forever. And I thought, you know, these gobies should have a vested interest in the health of the coral, because if the coral dies, they basically lose their home. And we ended up doing a series of scientific experiments to show that the coral actually releases a chemical that tells the goby that it's in danger, and then the goby comes over and it trims the algae so that the algae no longer is touching the coral, effectively saving its home. And that sort of idea was cool scientifically to me, that corals are able to talk to a fish using chemistry, but then also just the concept behind it and the thought process that went into developing the scientific idea, I thought could be broken down really easily into a children's book, because everyone does have a home, and, you know, if something happened to your home, what would you do? Kids can relate to that concept, so that was actually a pretty easy book to turn into a children's book.
Yeah, and what does it take to, you know, bring that high-level marine science down to a level that children can understand?
Yeah, that's one of those things where I feel like I've gotten better and better at it just because I've done a lot of remote field work. So most of my PhD was done in Papua New Guinea, and then my postdoc was done in Fiji. And because I've been working with in places where there's either a language barrier or a massive education barrier, I think it's a skill that you just kind of need to develop to be able to communicate with people not using jargony scientific language. So it definitely is something that is a skill that you develop. But for me, it's been developing over my entire career. I can tell you that some of my students struggle with it more than others, and a lot of that depends on how they interact with people and the people they interact with.
Right. But, do you think that there's some material in your research that's impossible to turn into a children's book?
I don't. That is coming from someone who does primarily marine conservation research, and I work on coral reef animals. So one of the main animals I work on are clownfish, which already lends itself to a pretty easy children's book given Finding Nemo.
Right.
And they're really recognizable to kids. Most of the animals I work with are just fish in general. I think that being said, it would be much more challenging if I worked on, I don't know, like zooplankton or something like that. That might maybe a harder topic to come across to kids, but I don't think it's impossible regardless of what you work on.
So your research has shown that ocean acidification brings about pretty drastic impacts on marine life, that, for example, it can badly alter cognitive ability in fish, causing them to wander into areas of the ocean that are unhealthy for them. So to what extent do you think the public understands what's happening in our oceans?
Yeah, so I don't think people understand what's happening in the oceans hardly at all. I think unlike something like deforestation or something where it's on the terrestrial ground and you can see it, people can see vast areas of forests that have been cleared or burned or things like that. The ocean is having nearly the same things happen to them with trawlers and all kinds of destructive fishing practices, but because it's underwater, people don't see it, and therefore it's hard to get energy and focus on those kind of topics. Ocean acidification is a kind of a silent issue just because it's not something that happens super quickly. It's slowly building up, and it's been building up since the Industrial Revolution. Even as scientists, we don't understand fully what all is happening in ocean acidification, and so definitely the general public has a harder time grasping it. So I do have two stories on ocean acidification, one on sharks and how they're affected in ocean acidification, and one on clownfish.
How are sharks affected by ocean acidification?
So far what we know, they're affected in almost the opposite way as the clownfish. So when clownfish are put under ocean acidification waters, they are attracted to everything. So every smell is interesting to them, and they are more aggressive and more bold, and they stay farther away from their anemones, things like that. They'll be attracted to the smell of a predator instead of repulsed by it. Sharks actually are the opposite, so they seem to not be as aggressive in terms of tracking their food. When they're provided with like a food stimulus, they don't really investigate it as much as they would under control conditions, but they are definitely significantly affected by ocean acidification.
Right. And how do you turn that into, again, a children's story? It seems like those individual stories don't seem to have a good ending to them.
Yeah, that's sort of the problem with any of with the ocean acidification story. It's hard to turn it into a children's story where there's a happy ending. Usually at the end of the ocean acidification stories, we have a, like, what can you do to help with this? And I mean, there are things as simple as ride your bike to school instead of have your parents drive your car. Like, you know, make sure you turn your lights off. Make sure you do. There's a lot of things that just normal people can do without really going completely out of their way, or even a six-year-old could remember to do without having it be a huge disruption to their daily lives. It's one of those things where it is a hard thing to try and spin into, but no, everything's fine, because it's really not, and we don't know how to make things better. But I usually try and end those stories with, what can you do to help?
And since we're on the topic of children's literature, how did you get interested in becoming a marine scientist to begin with?
I've always wanted to be a marine biologist, so I guess we took a trip to the Shedd Aquarium when I was a kid. I'm originally from Minnesota, so about as far from the ocean as you can get in the U.S. And I asked a question to one of the guides, and he gave me a book on whales. And ever since I got that book, I just kept saying, I want to be a marine biologist. And sort of my answer to what do you want to be when you grow up never changed. And as I got older and older, I think my parents sort of thought it would change, but it never did, and they were always really supportive of me and my dreams and wanted me to do what I wanted to do. So I just kept going with it.